Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, David from The Thistle here. Thanks for coming back. And just before we get into our chat with Chris Custer, I wanted to introduce you to our sponsors for today. That's Messrs. Whisky & Co. Messrs. Whisky & Co. provide consultancy, experiences, and media services to the Scotch whisky industry and its consumers. If you're ever in need of professional support to grow or enhance your whisky offering, or want to put on a bespoke tasting for family, friends, or clients, contact John from Messrs on Instagram, that's at Messrs Whiskey, or go to www.messrswhiskey.com. And if you tell him that you have found out via the Thistle Scottish Rugby Pod, you will get a 10% discount on all your services. So for all of your whiskey needs, get on to messrswhiskey.com. Cheers. So absolutely thrilled to be joined today for a Thistle lockdown session by Scotland and Lions scrum half, Chris Custer. Chris, how are you, man?
Good, thank you, David. Yeah, very, very well. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. I think you are our most sort of international guest we've ever had. You're joining us from West Coast of America. How's life out there at the moment?
I guess like everywhere, it's different. The last 3-4 months have been very, very strange, but I think there's probably worse places to be in this kind of situation. Like the weather is really good. So the beaches by and large have been open for the last couple of months. And, the ability to get outdoors and is there all the time. So I think we could be in a worse situation. We're trying to make the best of it. My wife and I have 2 young kids, so, that brings its own challenges. But, California's definitely a good place to be at the moment. And we're trying to enjoy it and not get too bogged down in everything that's happening.
Absolutely. How long have you been, away from Scotland? How long have you been in California now?
We moved to California in June of 2016. We left Scotland in 2014 when I signed for Sale Sharks, when I left Glasgow Warriors and was there for 2 years. And pretty much as soon as we kind of finished up in Manchester, we had a week or so or a couple of weeks, I think. And then we moved out here. So yeah, just gone 4 years, which is kind of strange. It's the longest I think we've lived anywhere other than Glasgow outside of Aberdeen. and it's kind of going quickly and it's not going quickly and it seems normal now, but it's been a kind of fairly busy 4 years, I guess, with finishing rugby and starting this business and moving over here, and we had our second kid, and a lot of kind of stuff has happened in that 4 years. So yeah, it's been really busy.
So before we get into that rugby, what is it? What is the business? What are you up to out there?
So I bought an alcohol retail business. When I was in the last 18 months, 2 years maybe of playing rugby, I was looking to the future and trying to decide what I wanted to do. And I had a few ideas, but I kind of got into Scotch whiskey a little bit got really interested in it. And I decided, or we decided also, that we wanted to try and live in California for a while at least. We really liked it out here, and we thought that after rugby was the time to do it, because if we moved back to Scotland and bought a house and settled down, that we might never do it. So we kind of did everything at once. I have a friend out here who actually used to play for Gordonians in Aberdeen back in the day, which is how I knew him. And he'd been out here for quite a few years and is in the Scotch whiskey business. So I started talking to him a little bit more, and he knew this business. It was an old family business that kind of father and son had run, and they were looking to sell. So he suggested, you know, that it might be something worth looking at, and I needed to get a visa to come over here. I had to purchase a business. So kind of over the next year and a half, I started kind of putting that together. And there's a business in the UK called the Whiskey Exchange that I got interested in and thought it was an incredible business and a great business model. And really my plan was to try and replicate that over in California. So it's definitely still a work in progress, but yeah, it's been a good venture for sure.
Awesome. So there is life after rugby, you found.
There's life after rugby, and it's in some ways way harder, in some ways easier. And I think 4 years in, I understand it better. I understand the real world better. But that transition is pretty tough. I've never owned my own business before, and I'd never worked for anybody before other than, you know, playing professional rugby. And I think that I played for 13 years, which was, you know, as they would say out here, it's a blessing, but it definitely, you know, puts you on the back foot when you come out of that age 34, because it's all I'd ever known. I went straight from university to the borders and playing rugby. So all my friends and contemporaries from school and university were 13 years into a career, and were becoming quite senior, and, you know, some of them doing quite well for themselves. And having played rugby, you forgo all that, and obviously I wouldn't have it any other way. But you come out of that age 34, and I was married with one kid at the time, and you take a huge drop in income, and you start to realize you actually don't know very much about anything other than playing rugby, which is no good when you're not playing rugby anymore. So it's been a steep learning curve for sure. I think we kind of did it, I'm not saying the hard way, but we took on a lot. And I think in some ways that was good. It was kind of straight into the deep end, and there was a lot of pressure, but it was a steeper learning curve, and maybe helped with the transition once we got through that initial kind of first year or 18 months.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's where you are now. I mean, take us right back. Obviously, you're Aberdeen is where you were born and raised. And I take it that's where you sort of first picked up a rugby ball, and what first got you interested in the sport?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, from Aberdeen. My dad had played rugby for Gordonians. And obviously loved it, and kind of pushed my brother and I in that direction. So it was really, we went to a school that played rugby, one of the, probably the only rugby playing schools in Aberdeen, and, you know, picked it up and kind of straight away just really, really enjoyed it. And, you know, was quite good at it. And, Aberdeen is not really a hotbed of rugby in Scotland. It's a bit off the beaten track, and the competition isn't much in Aberdeen. So we're all, you know, every weekend you travel down to Edinburgh, Glasgow to play against the strong rugby playing schools down there. But yeah, I just really enjoyed it. Played a bunch of other sports, but rugby was always the main one. And obviously with dad playing, and, you know, he encouraged us and pushed us in that direction. So And my big brother played as well, and he was one of those annoyingly kind of well-developed guys at school who, you know, had hairy legs before everyone else did and was stronger than everyone else. So I was always kind of trying to compete with him and keep up with him. I was the opposite. I was really small. But, you know, having my brother as a kind of role model and somebody to aspire to was really helpful. And, you know, we played together for 1 year when he was in his last year of school and I was in fourth year. So that was really fun. But yeah, I don't know. It seemed natural. I always loved it. And to be honest, I think I didn't really know how far I could go, but I just loved playing it. It gave me a focus. And when I went to university in Edinburgh, obviously that was quite a well-trodden path. There wasn't really academies back then as such, like not in the way there is now. So played for a club team. I joined Watsonians in 2000, played there for a couple of years, did a year at Boro Muir. And I think by that point I was spending more time training and playing or, you know, thinking about rugby certainly than I was studying. And it was kind of affecting, you know, my marks and my grades. But by then I kind of knew what I wanted to do and I thought it was a possibility. So it just kind of got more and more serious, I guess, as I went to university. And yeah, I don't know. I didn't know at that point what was going to happen, but that was much more appealing than becoming a lawyer or whatever path I might have otherwise been on.
Absolutely. So you mentioned earlier you joined the much fated Boro Reavers when they were sort of from their inception in 2003, and stuck with them sort of right to the bitter end 2007. I mean, what was that journey like? I mean, obviously a brand new club starting up, and then obviously falling into nothingness after sort of 4 years. I mean, what was that journey like in that sort of third Scottish pro team?
Well, I didn't have anything to compare it to. You know, I'd played at Boro Muir the year before and had one of the most enjoyable years, I think, of rugby I'd had. Sean Lineen was coaching and we just had a really good team. Ali Warnock was there and Malcolm Clapperton, Ali Strokosh.
Yeah.
You know, a bunch of really good guys, like a really good club. So I just had a lot of fun and I kind of was in touch with Rob Moffat, was the Scotland under 19 coach around about then. And you know, I love Rob and we got on really well. And he was just brilliant as a kind of mentor. And, you know, like we used to do sessions together just on like a Wednesday afternoon or something. We'd go and pass balls. And, you know, I kept in touch with him and he was at Glasgow, but he ended up going to the Borders and kind of talked to me about maybe coming down there. And it's not like when you're 20, you have a lot of options really, you know? So, you know, I just needed one. I just wanted one opportunity to have a professional contract for a year and try and do it.
Yeah.
And Tony Gilbert was the head coach who had been an All Black coach. So that was pretty cool, you know, like having that experience of being coached by him and plus some of the older guys that were there. So Gary Armstrong, Doddy Weir, had signed from Newcastle, yeah. George Graham, some other guys who I'd watched growing up. Ian Fairley was there, Kevin Utterson, Stevie Scott, like a bunch of good solid players. And
yeah, there was some big names.
Yeah, it was. You know, and you know, when you look back at some of the players that were there and who went on to other clubs, like there's a lot of talent. But without having anything to compare it to, I didn't really know what professional rugby should be like. You know, you trained every day and, you know, but there's obviously different levels of that. And it was still fairly early on in professional rugby in Scotland. It was only like seven years old or something. So a lot of things were still getting figured out. And the Borders didn't have a big budget. And I don't think any of the teams actually had a big budget. And the Welsh teams, you know, seemed a little bit more developed, potentially more professional. I didn't really know. The Irish teams were good, so it was a slog, you know, like we didn't win many games. And I remember I had like a win bonus or something in my contract, and it was like, I don't know, like 300 quid for every win. And I was like, oh, this is great, you know, this will pay for a few things. And I think we won maybe three games or something.
That's decent.
My first year. Yeah, it was. As a 20-year-old or 21-year-old, it was huge. But it was tough going. Obviously, I stayed there for 4 years, first two were just kind of trying to learn and trying to get up to that speed and increased intensity. But pretty early on, Matt Williams was coach of Scotland. He got announced coach of Scotland, I guess, after the World Cup. So he was in touch and, you know, was talking about Six Nations. And, you know, I didn't really, you know, that was obviously the master plan, but it was kind of came really early. It came my first year, I guess. Yeah, it came my first year. Yeah. Mike Blair, he'd already had a year with Edinburgh and he had gone to the World Cup, but I guess hadn't played a lot, but he was more experienced. So, yeah, and then in February, I'd only been pro for a few months and end up starting the Six Nations. And so that, you know, that first year was a bit of a whirlwind. And, yeah, it was really fun. Yeah, like, I think anything that's new like that is fun, and it's all these experiences you're having and being able to train full time and getting paid for it just seemed like it was magical. So, no, I had a lot of fun in the first couple of years, definitely. And then...
When did you sort of see the writing on the wall, I guess, at the Borders? Was it sort of well-trailed that it was coming to an end? Or, I mean, as a player, what was it like in those sort of, I guess, the death throes of the Border Reavers?
Yeah, it was strange. You could tell that something was happening. I mean, I think when the forwards coach and the defence coach get taken out of the coaching team halfway through the season to go and coach with Scotland, then it's not a great sign. There's obviously no big plans there to build and grow. And the rumours started. I can't remember exactly what time of the year, but obviously there's rumours about it. And the writing was on the wall. And I think the second part of the season was, you know, it wasn't ideal. And it wasn't obviously the players. Like for me, like I knew that I could get another club at that point. And, you know, I think the SRU wanted me to go to Glasgow, and, you know, I considered it, but I really kind of wanted a change and I ended up going to France. But, you know, for some of the other players, like it's hard, like plenty of players picked up contracts or they were offered Edinburgh, Glasgow. Some guys maybe never played again. And also all the staff, you know, all the support staff and the admin staff, the physios, you know, that had been their life for 5 years, I think the Borders was around. Like, yeah. You know, and it was a good community. Everyone got on really well. And it's kind of sad that just got just disbanded like that. All those people lost jobs and maybe never worked in professional rugby again. So there was definitely a bit of sadness there. I don't know if it could have been handled better, maybe, but it's a tough decision. Like, there's going to be consequences of that kind of thing. And I think maybe it was ultimately the correct one.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Because there wasn't enough money to support three teams properly. So having two well-funded teams was, I think, probably a better model, but it didn't make it any easier. And I do feel for the people that maybe never worked in professional rugby again. It's quite a brutal kind of way to end it.
But as you said, you enjoyed some success during those years, including a call up to the Lions tour in 2005. What are your memories from that? Obviously not a hugely successful time on the pitch for the Lions, but what was it like to go touring with that team?
Yeah, honestly, one of the best times of my life. Just to be selected in the first place, I think, was beyond anything I ever would have dreamed about. I was there in 2001. I was with Watsonians. We went and to Australia to follow the tour, you know, just in university and just, you know, having a great time. So to be on the next one 4 years later was honestly just a dream come true. And yeah, I loved it. I loved every second of it. I played in the midweek team, and I think we're pretty much undefeated. So there was lower pressure. The games were obviously easier, but yeah, some of the people I met and the players I played with, like, I absolutely loved it. And I guess at that point, you know, I would have hoped to have gone on, you know, one or two more tours after that. It didn't happen for various reasons. So no, I look back on that really fondly, and you know, I obviously wish I'd maybe snuck onto the bench for one of the tests. Like, I thought maybe I had a chance of that, but Sir Clive went with Matt Dawson on the bench, who he obviously knew really well. But you know, the whole thing was just incredible. I wouldn't have changed a thing. It was brilliant.
So you were saying part of the midweek side, was it a proper sort of midweek touring side? Big characters on that tour and sort of on the drink quite a bit.
It was a proper tour. Like, you know, it's 2005, so it's not that long ago. I mean, God, it's 15 years ago, but it was professional, but it was fun, and the games were intense. But you know, it wasn't the test match kind of intensity, and it wasn't the same kind of pressure. And there's guys like Donico Callahan, who was on that tour, who's a great character, really funny. And, you know, I remember all like the songs that they were coming up with, and, you know, just it was a really good laugh. And, you know, I got on really well with everyone. We had some fun nights out, kind of under the radar. I remember after they announced the team for the third test, I guess. We were up in Auckland, the series is gone. And they announced the team or the squad. And if you weren't in it, then they basically flew us all down to Queenstown for the night. And, you know, we just got to go out in Queenstown and spend the day and the night up there. And then we flew back to Auckland on the morning of the test. And, I didn't think about it then. Obviously, if somebody had gotten sick overnight, you could have been potentially being involved. But we'd been out in Queenstown until like 3-4 in the morning. And I actually think it happened to, it might have been Gordy Bullock. I think Gordy Bullock had been out, and then somebody got sick, and I think he was on standby or something. I can't remember if he made the squad or if he was on standby, but I remember thinking if something happened to Matt Dawson or Dwayne Peel and I was next in line, I would have been in the worst condition of, you know, of that tour to then sit on the bench against the All Blacks. And obviously you'd kind of want it to happen, but also not exactly ideal preparation. Kind of like Andy Nicol in 2001 when he wasn't even on the tour, but then got called on the bench, having been leading the tourists. Anyway, it didn't happen. You know, thankfully, I guess. Although, you know, you take a Lions cap in any circumstances. But
I mean, it's become a bit of a bone of contention, I think, for Scottish rugby. Certainly, Scottish rugby fans, particularly in the last few tours, has been fairly limited involvement from Scottish players. I mean, do you think it's something that Scots really need to sort of turn their attention to and they should still be striving for as players? I mean, there's certainly a little bit of the fan community that feels quite snubbed by the whole exercise. But I presume you're a huge sort of proponent of the whole Lions club and particularly Scottish involvement in it.
Yeah, I think so. And as a player, like, it is the pinnacle, I think, if you're a British player. I mean, representing Scotland is amazing, but that's, you know, it's once every 4 years, and it's a selection from, you know, from several countries. So it is still the pinnacle. I feel that frustration over the last couple of tours, and I think it's, you know, if you have a coach like Gatland, who's one of the best coaches in history, but who's coached Wales and knows those players and obviously doesn't particularly rate the Scottish players, he's not going to, any 50-50 call is not going to go to a Scottish player. And I think that's where it started to seem unfair. But that's from a Scottish perspective. And if you're Warren Gatland and you've coached against Scotland and you've always beaten them and you know your players, it's probably it's a natural bias. But I did get a wee bit disillusioned with the 2013 tour. I felt that we were a wee bit hard done by, but, you know, the calls are close. You know, there's very, very good Scottish players that could have gone and didn't. And, you felt a wee bit hard done by, but there was no great injustice if you try to look at it from a neutral. The players that went were excellent players. You know, there was no ringers there. Obviously, what happened in New Zealand was I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that they picked people on proximity. Mm. That's just, to me, that's not right. Like that, a British player, no matter where they are in the world or what they're doing, would drop everything and get on a plane and be in New Zealand, you know, as soon as they could to be part of that tour. So to call people up just because you know them and they're close by, that's not right. And I don't think the end justified the means there. It kind of devalues it, and that shouldn't have happened. But, you know, it was a successful tour, but to me it left a bit of a bitter taste. And I would hope that they could not do that again. I just think it's not fair. It's not fair on the players who would otherwise deserve to go and have maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to become a British and Irish Lion. So, yeah, that bit I didn't like. But, you know, I'm optimistic. I think if Stuart Hogg had been fit, then he would have started in the test. And, you know, he's one of Scotland's best ever players. He was just unlucky to pick up that injury. And next time round, you know, if Finn Russell is on form and Stuart Hogg and, you know, a bunch of other young guys that we have who are really good players, we've got a good shot. But, you know, the competition's huge, and we're a small country who hasn't traditionally done well in the Six Nations. So I try not to be too close-minded about it. But, yeah, obviously a greater Scottish representation would be fantastic, and I hope it happens next time round.
Absolutely, completely agree. So your Scotland career, you said, you made your debut, was it 2004, did you say?
Yeah, that's right.
And that was under Matt Williams. What are your memories from that sort of first cap and your first sort of your early Scotland involvement?
I think being fairly terrified was one emotion. It was at the Millennium Stadium, which is one of the most incredible stadiums in the world, and my family were all down, and I, you know, just a really emotional day. You know, for my mum and dad, and my brother was there, and yeah, it was, you know, in its own way, kind of magical. The game didn't go particularly well for Scotland, and I think I'd only been playing for the Borders for like 6 months, and it was probably a wee bit too early for me, if I'm honest. But you know, you're not going to turn it down. So I was trying to kind of learn on the hoof, you know, learn about professional rugby, learn about international rugby as, you know, as a 21-year-old. So yeah, it was a bit of a baptism of fire, but yeah, good memories. I mean, those are some of the things I'll remember for the rest of my life. And it was quite tough with like Matt Williams. He really backed me for those first couple of years. Like I think I started like, I don't know, the first 14, 15 games or something. So I got great experience under him, and you know, had a lot of enjoyable games, but it was tough. We didn't win many games, so yeah, kind of mixed experiences there. But you know, honestly, growing up in Aberdeen, if you told me that I think I got a Scotland A cap in 2003, that to me seemed like, you know, it could be the pinnacle, and I'd be happy with that. So these experiences were all somewhat unexpected and incredible at the same time. So yeah, I've got good memories for sure.
Obviously, went on to win 70 Scotland caps, a huge total. What is there any particular games or sort of coaches or moments that stick out to you in your career as like that was when you really felt that you and that Scotland were going really, really well?
I don't know. The 2000s were pretty tough. Like we never had any sustained period of success. You know, and I'm sure if the fans at that time would obviously relate to that. Like we had some reasonable one-off victories and performances. There was, you know, so 2006, Frank Haddon came in and, you know, preferred Mike Blair. So, you know, had some starts and had some injury issues starting to come in. And I think, I guess 2006, there's three wins in the Six Nations, but, you know, personally, I wasn't, you know, hugely involved. But they were still enjoyable, you know, still fun to beat England at Murrayfield. You know, that was pretty cool, being France at Murrayfield. So, you know, those are enjoyable. And I remember, you know, being Italy away with Chris Patterson kicking a kind of fairly last-minute penalty. You know, those are good memories. I enjoyed the summer tours. Yeah. They were always really fun, like going to Australia in 2004. And we played Samoa in Wellington, which we won, and, you know, really enjoyable. Playing against George Gregan, you know, down there, like, who I'd kind of watched a lot and had, you know, analyzed a lot. So to play against him was really, yeah, it was very cool. Then, I don't know, like, so, Andy Robertson came in, and I really got on really well with Andy initially. And, you know, his attention to detail was fantastic. And I really enjoyed working with him. He's very, very personable and really, really cared a lot. And initially it was really enjoyable. He made Mike and I captain, so, you know, was able to captain Scotland again, which was an honor and a privilege and great. But I remember 2010, maybe, we were the England game at Murrayfield. So I was captain, and I think we drew the game, if I remember, but it was like one of those, like, so near yet so far. And I remember at one point kind of throwing a dummy and making a break, and I'm not sure if I would have scored, but I might have done. But I ended up getting caught by Dan Cole, the tight end, dropped, like, by his fingernails, and it was like, so frustrating, you know. So never got a chance to lift the Calcutta Cup, but I'd say it was more little bits and pieces, obviously, rather than any sustained success. Yeah,
you mentioned that there, that decision to make you and Mike sort of joint captains. Obviously, like, joint captains, I imagine, has their pros and cons anyway, but joint captains of two people in the same position, was that not quite, I suppose, quite strange for you and Mike, knowing that you were sort of not only competing for the number 9 jersey, but whichever one got it would be captain?
Kind of, but I quite enjoyed it, to be honest. I think by then, I feel like Mike and I got on pretty well. Like, we're good friends now. In the early days, it was a bit tougher, but I think by then we'd kind of, you know, we got on pretty well, and it worked. It definitely worked in the early days because I got to start, so that was more enjoyable. Then I think it flipped maybe the next year, or, you know, and then it just got a little bit harder. But yeah, the competition was there anyway, so it didn't really. Yeah, whoever started was captain, so that, to be honest, it suited me. I was happy with that. And I enjoy working with Mike. I always kind of enjoy competing with him, and yeah, as we got older and a bit more mature, it was fun to do that together. So yeah, I guess, you know, like any, yeah, like most of the players, we would have wanted more success. You know, it was more one-off victories rather than any sustained runs or, you know, trying to play for championships. So, you know, there's that, but yeah, you know, still enjoyable experiences. And you know, they're amazing things to do, you know, to play in those stadiums, to represent your country. You're never going to regret it, but when you get to that point, you do want success, you want to win, and you want, you know, everyone to be involved and the country to be involved in those good times. And obviously
you and Mike sort of two of the sort of absolute stalwarts in the 9 jersey in Scotland. There's a long sort of lineage of strong scrum halves in Scottish rugby. What do you make of the current crop, Ali Price, George Horn, and the rest?
I guess, so Ali Price, I know a little bit. He was at Glasgow when I was there, and he's got, you know, well, he's got potential, but he's already a very, very good player, very accomplished, good kicker, good passer, good athlete, and I like watching him. I really like watching George Horn, who I don't know, but I know his big brother Pete, having played together, but I think he's a great player, and he's really exciting. And I get quite excited to watch him play because I feel like he's got that ability to create something or to get on the end of a scoring pass, as he does regularly for Glasgow. So yeah, I'm excited by those guys. So yeah, I guess it'll be interesting to see how they develop and which one maybe takes hold of it now that Greg has stepped down. But yeah, no, there's good players at scrum half for sure, and it just depends who kind of steps up and who's able to take it on.
I'm kind of jumping all over the place a little bit here, but I wanted to touch on your time at Perpignan. I mean, I think you still hear stories today about the sort of professionalism of French rugby. I mean, that's in sort of 2019-20. What was it like going to Perpignan, playing in the top 14 in 2007? Was it a big sort of, obviously a massive culture shock from the borders, but was there a sort of professionalism gap as well?
If I'm honest, not with the borders. They have a different attitude to strength and conditioning for sure. They're much more, it's old fashioned, it's not very scientific, and it's not very intense. So I kind of realized that, and I think at times some of the Scottish rugby stuff was overly intense, and there was so much focus on it over, it seemed, maybe skill or just rugby. So yeah, it was the other way around. Like they wanted to play rugby and kind of focus on individual skill, and the structure was not massive, but the coach at the time who was Jacques Brunel, who had been with the French team, he kind of put in a fairly basic structure, and he was a bit of a kind of school headmaster type figure. But I felt like they kind of worked for the French players. Like they could be quite kind of lackadaisical, so they needed somebody like that to get the best out of them. And yeah, he got the team playing really well. You know, it's Perpignan, we won the top 14 in 2009. But yeah, it was very different. Like the preseason I did in 2008, I think was probably the easiest preseason I ever did. But I actually felt the best I ever had. Also, I wasn't exhausted. I wasn't knackered all the time, and started the season really well. And some of the, it's a great league. I mean, the stadiums you play at and some of the players you play with were immense. So yeah, that was fun. I mean, Guillaume Garrido was there. He was a young hooker who, you know, has gone on to become a French captain, or Nico Mas, the prop who played for France, you know, got a number of caps for France. David Marty, the centre, Percy Montgomery signed, Henry Tuolangi. Like, there's some amazing players. So yeah, it was fun. It was a really fun experience. Yeah. And playing at home in that stadium, the Aimé Jarrell, was incredible. Like the crowd are so partisan and so passionate that it was, yeah, if you played at home, you almost always won. And
sounds absolutely amazing. I'll just try and bring this all to a bit of a close. You mentioned some absolutely awesome big names that you've played with there. One question that we usually ask to all of our guests is, who's the best player that you've ever played with?
I mean, the obvious one is Dan Carter. He signed for Perpignan in 2008 and played 1 year, but got injured after five games. But we played a couple of games together, so he's one of the greatest players of all time. We played two games together, but I think it still counts. Henry Tuolangi is just an absolute force of nature, and I've never seen anyone who could do the things he could do. Like physically, he was just pure power. So, you know, somewhere between those two, obviously on the Lions tour, like Johnny Wilkinson and Charlie Hodgson are just amazing players. But I guess, you know, Henry Tuolangi, just for sheer physicality, was up there. Dan Carter is Dan Carter. So yeah, there's, I don't know, I guess between those two guys.
Pretty big names, to be fair. And the last question that we usually ask everyone is, through all your time in rugby, who's the worst roommate you've ever had?
I don't remember. I've never had any terrible roommates, but and I'm going to throw him under the bus a bit, but Jeff Cross used to sleep naked, which caught me off guard the first time it happened. And he wasn't shy about it, or he wouldn't try and be discreet. So I saw a lot more of Jeff Cross than I would otherwise have wished to see. So sorry, Jeff, but it would probably happen. Sorry.
I think he's actually been mentioned before. I think him and Tim Visser crop up quite a lot for their love of being naked in the hotel room. So you're not the first.
Well, Tim is Dutch, so he's got an excuse, but Jeff's from Gala, so I don't know how that happened.
Chris, thanks very much for giving us some of your time to just sort of have a bit of a reminisce and talk about your career. We really, really appreciate it, and wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll chat again soon.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, David. Good to chat.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.